Perspectives in Pulmonary Medicine presents an interview with Dr. Hurley Motley. This is an unusual opportunity to listen to this pioneer in pulmonary medicine discuss his long and noteworthy career in treating pulmonary disease. Dr. Motley, currently living in Los Angeles, gives his perspectives on the beginnings of pulmonary medicine and provides insights into many of his own contributions. His interviewer is Dr. Thomas L. Petty, head of the Division of Pulmonary Medicine at the University of Colorado. This interview is made available to interested medical and paramedical personnel by Perspectives in Pulmonary Medicine, a service of Breon Laboratories.
Dr. Hurley Motley, it's very good to be with you once again and to have an opportunity to visit about our changing field of pulmonary medicine and respiratory care. Do you mind if I ask you some questions about your early work?
Not at all.
I'm particularly interested, and I know that everyone else is, about the development of pressure breathing and your work during the war with the pressure breathing devices for artificial respiration.
Well, that's where I got started in working with pressure breathing, was during World War II.
What was the reason?
The Army Air Force at that time was interested in improving artificial respiration in wounded flying personnel, particularly on the B-17s and B-24s. See, they had oxygen under pressure, they had pressure demand regulators, but methods of giving artificial respiration were unsatisfactory. They had a lot of casualties in the early days of the war.
So they had oxygen under pressure, and you could breathe with a mask, but there needed to be a better way to support these casualties.
Well, unless if they'd stopped breathing, they didn't do them any good, and then the manual methods were inefficient. So they were interested in providing some type of device, if they could, that would give artificial respiration. And since they did have pressure demand regulators, all they needed was something that would interrupt that pressure to provide it.
This was the beginning of intermittent positive pressure breathing.
At that time, at Aeromed Laboratory in Dayton, Ohio, they had an engineer there on full time, Mr. Burns, and V. Ray Bennett was a consulting engineer. And Burns devised a little valve that would fit in the hose of the equipment they already had on the airplane that would interrupt a positive pressure, giving it an intermittent positive pressure breathing.
So you had two different valves, Burns and Bennett, and from that came pressure breathing machines as things developed.
Yes, I would say so. Initially, at that time, they were more concerned with the Burns valve because it seemed to be more applicable to use on the plane. The Bennett valve was still considered much more a research tool. The Bennett X2 that they made really had six variables on it that you could control: intermittent inspiratory positive pressure, expiratory positive pressure, instantaneous flow rate, expiratory flow rate. You can put on expiratory positive pressure, and then the demand regulator on the airplane had settings. You could put 15, 20, or 30 centimeters of water pressure. So you had six variables.
That strikes me as a tremendous amount of versatility and something that we need and, in fact, are studying today as we evaluate pressure waveforms. Shortly after your military experience, you did some very fundamental scientific inquiries into pressure waveforms and the effect on cardiac output, as I remember your writing.
Yes, they were very much concerned about that, the use of pressure breathing devices on what it might do to cardiac output. And that's when they sent me to Bellevue Hospital to work with Dr. Kernon and Richards to study the effect of intermittent positive pressure breathing on cardiac output.
That was very key work, in my opinion, and I've read it all over and over again, the effect of these different pressure waveforms on both inspiration and expiration on hemodynamics.
Well, we found that cardiac output was correlated with a mean mass pressure. And the time cycle was important. That is, you wanted enough time on expiration to allow for the decrease on inspiration.
So out of this came a short inspiratory, long expiratory pattern.
Yes, well, expiration at least is longer, a little bit longer than inspiration.
Now, was this in animals or in human volunteers or both?
Human volunteers all.
And this was pioneering work. Cardiac catheterization was not common in the mid and late 40s.
No, when I first went there, oftentimes we got into the right atrium, what you consider successful. The equipment was very crude. My first experience with Dr. Cournon was holding one of these hand fluoroscopes that you look into, and once in a while he'd let me take a look in and see where the tip of the catheter was.
You didn't have pressure wave monitoring. These were passed under direct fluoroscopic control.
Yes.
You know, it strikes me that today we take cardiac catheterization for granted. We put flow-directed catheters in almost every day, but of course the knowledge on how to do that and the importance of it goes back to the original discoveries of you along with the famous Drs. Cournon and Richards.
Well, Dr. Cournon and Richards, of course, deserve the credit for the catheterization and the pioneering in that field. I simply happened to be there in the early days when a lot of people regarded it as almost malpractice, you might say. They used to kid me down in the dining room there, well, what's Cournon doing today? There was a lot of suspicion and misapprehension of the staff at the hospital, but he had visitors there from all over the world while I was there. Matter of fact, Dr. Worko came over from Sweden just to get in on the early days of the cardiac catheterization.
Must have been a tremendously exciting time.
And I say the equipment we had was very crude. We started out with these Hamilton manometers. I don't know whether you know what a Hamilton manometer is, but it's just as well as you know.
I'm afraid I don't.
Took one man most full time to keep it going because it was set up so that sensitivity was never the same. You had to calibrate everything. It is the beginning and the end of every run. They used a beryllium copper membrane with a little mirror that was mounted on this beryllium copper, and it would give a little bit with the pressure. And movement of the mirror with the light reflected on it was focused on a camera so that you got tracings. Today, well, like a Stassen gauge, there's nothing to it anymore. It's so simple to do. But in the early days, it was really something. Dr. Cournon was very much enthusiast of the Hamilton manometer. When I went from right field, I was able to take over some electronic recording equipment to improvise the cardiac pressure capsule, which they used in the Air Force for stress testing on airplanes. We were able to hook that up and record electronically the pulse pressure. Dr. Cournon was so suspicious of that we had to run the same tracing on the same patient to compare the Hamilton with the electronic.
This was a day of real innovation.
We published a little paper on it. It was the first paper on electronic recording.
Is that right?
Using the Clark pressure capsule. We simply had to fill it with mineral oil because saline would disrupt it. There was no problem on the airplane because there they had air. Well, we were able to make electronic recording. Then with the use of that, we were able to do some recordings of the pulmonary artery pressure with exercise with people sitting on a bicycle. We couldn't do that with a Hamilton manometer because it had rigid lead tubing, whereas the other we could use wire. And these were three doctors. Dr. Riley published this paper. He's the first name on this, the effect of exercise on pulmonary artery pressure.
Of course, we're still very interested in this, particularly in patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases. But then you took your pressure breathing devices, or the devices that industry was beginning to build, and you applied these to patients with obstructive lung diseases. And you did some of this work at Jefferson, I believe, after you left and went back into academic medicine after you left the military duty.
Yes. I went to Jefferson Medical College when I left the Army Air Forces. That was in 1947. Jefferson had a grant to set up the lab from the Anthracite Health and Welfare to study coal miners. So most of the people I studied in Jefferson were coal miners with silicosis.
But this was new. This was a new breathing device eventually used as a therapeutic maneuver for these patients with various lung diseases working in mines.
Yeah. In our pulmonary function studies, we found that when we tested them on the pressure breathing, that the pulmonary artery saturation went up and the PO2 increased. That was one reason we started using it with the bronchodilator, because most of them were bringing up a lot of secretions. They had a lot of trouble with the breathing. And one of the early observations I made on pressure breathing to promote bronchial drainage is that some of these coal miners, some of them had been out of the mines for as long as 2 years, and after 2 or 3 days with the pressure breathing treatments, they started spitting up black, which they recognized as soot or coal dust. I still don't know where that was trapped, but nevertheless, that was true. And one of the earliest observations I made convinced me that the pressure breathing did promote bronchial drainage.
I just reread your article in the American Journal of Medicine, 1948.
Yes.
Which was the first description of combining aerosol bronchodilators with pressure breathing.
That's right.
And in there you recount these experiences. Although we both know that pressure breathing remains somewhat controversial and is under study, I think these original observations were very important.
One of the things that convinced me was objective quantitative measurements of arterial blood, because to me, the arterial blood reflects what's going on in the lungs. And it is true that many of them did hyperventilate some with the pressure breathing, but on some of them, where it was given properly and we could get them to breathe slowly and more deeply, without increasing ventilation, we've gotten a significant improvement in the arterial PO2. And that led us to the feeling that we were improving alveolar ventilation.
So pattern and rate were both important.
Yeah. We made an exhibit back in 48. With lights behind it, it looked like blood was flowing. A poorly ventilated alveoli, the blood was not as red on ambient breathing. Then with IPPB, it was brightened up. And we had the function studies in the center there. We had 6 cases. The X-ray would light up and show the significant function measurements. I might state here that really my philosophy on pulmonary function tests has been a carryover from Richards and Cournot, and I have expanded some aspects of it. My background was in physiology and in doing pulmonary function.
You were an early champion of pulmonary function as an objective measurement of patient care, of disability, of various different disease states.
Yes, at Jefferson we had the problem of evaluating as many patients as we could, and when we started giving them pressure breathing treatment, that seemed to help them, at least they felt it did, and we got so routinely, every patient we studied that had a low PO2, we would try them on pressure breathing to see if the PO2 improved. I think today one of the things that has happened, that is, IPPB has been used indiscriminately on a lot of people where there's really no indication for it, just like steroids are used where there's no indication. We know that regardless of what we do, a certain amount of them are going to feel better.
Absolutely.
But I've tried to base my conclusions on what I could demonstrate in the laboratory, in the pulmonary function laboratory, and it was spectacular. These coal miners, most all of them were smokers, as well as being exposed to silica. But the amount of secretions that they brought up was really tremendous. And we had some of them, after they'd been on it for 2 weeks, had practically dried up. That was very striking.
Beforehand, they probably had no systematic care for their disease.
And then routinely, we would check spirometric measurements before and after a bronchodilator.
You know, I'm amazed today that everyone doesn't do spirometric tests before and after potent bronchodilators.
That's been my routine over all the years. It is just routinely a spirogram. That's a simple and an easy thing to do as you've written, and for a screening test, you can't beat it.
But why has it taken so long for this, something as simple as spirometry to be established in the office practice of medicine?
Well, pulmonary function was something new. It took time to catch on, I think, just like many other things have.
Maybe it's been a little too mysterious along the way.
Well, there's a certain amount of technique required in doing good spirometry, and some technicians still don't do it very good. That is, I'm sure in your laboratory and mine, our technicians were trained to do it properly.
We have to strive for accuracy, but at the same time, get application of a tool as fundamental as spirometry. You agree with that or not?
I really don't know why it's taken so long. As you say, it is so simple to do. It doesn't take very much time. And we, I say, we've done it routinely before and after bronchodilators over all these years.
You were one of the first to show that just slow breathing, even to a metronome, improves gas transfer.
Yes, I followed some patients, four or five follow-up studies over a period of years. They were, tend to breathe slower and deeper. We had a device that we could set up a breathing pattern so that we could accentuate inspiration and have the patient follow this, hoping that they might do this while they were asleep. And unfortunately, they would follow the pattern when they were awake. And in almost everyone that we studied, we were able to show some improvement. In a few cases, as much as we could do with IPPB, but not in all. So the pattern of breathing is important. And that's why I think it's so important for the technician when they're using IPPB. We felt one of the biggest hazards was the improper use of it.
So we have oxygen, pressure breathing, pattern, aerosol. That's almost the essence of what we call pulmonary rehabilitation today, if you put it all together. At least the ingredients are there.
I had the opportunity to follow one patient out here from 1952 till he died in 1975, that had a unit that he used at home. And I had about five follow-up studies on this man. And his emphysema did not progress over this period of time. And he was very short of breath the first time I studied him. But his core pulmonality did progress, and he died in heart failure. But it was interesting, because we had complete studies on him, that his residual air did not increase. His PO2, PCO2 stayed about the same. His spirogram, of course, showed the severe obstructive pattern, with some decrease in vital capacity over the years. But the long-range effect of that was interesting, that he could use it so long, and I feel sure it prolonged his life. And at Bellevue, where I had a chance to use it more in resuscitation, one period there, 3 months, I took all calls from emergency on Bellevue, where there was a respiratory problem. And some of the anesthesiologists, when they had a patient that wasn't breathing, they were squeezing the bag, they would get tired and they would call me. And we had a chance to follow a number of patients that way over quite a period of time. So in several cases of acute pulmonary edema, I've had the experience of using just dry oxygen with IPPB in treating acute pulmonary edema. With the Burns valve, even in Dr. Kernan's lab, we found it was a little more effective in cardiacs than non-cardiacs because there was a slight positive pressure at the end of expiration, type 1 curve. And he would decrease cardiac output some and improve cardiac performance.
That sounds very much like PEEP to me, Hurley-Malik.
It is. If you're looking at one of my publications where we have those three types of curve, that type 1 curve does have a little positive pressure. But of course, in Bellevue, we were interested in the type of curve with the least disturbance in cardiac output because that's what the Air Force was most interested in. I've often thought of that. Here's an early PEEP right there.
Hurley, it is obvious to me that the IPPB machine was really the forerunner of the modern ventilator that we use in intensive care units all the time. To me, that's one of its major importances today. I think without your aircraft work and without the pressure breathing machine being studied, that I think we wouldn't be where we are with artificial ventilatory support.
Yes, I think that's true. I think one of the big factors here that's been helpful over the years has been the improved training on the technicians who have made a lot of suggestions from their use to the manufacturer so they could improve the apparatus.
So I think the devices are improving all the time. We still, though, go back to fundamentals, which is a certain time for inspiration and expiration. And of course, we're still looking at pressure waveform modifications as things that may improve gas transfer, such as PEEP, which was which goes way back.
Well, this just requires, to me, more study where we can obtain it on the patient using the arterial blood to reflect what's going on in the lungs. This is an objective quantitative measurement.
You've always used arterial blood, even when it wasn't very commonly employed in the care of patients.
That's correct. And I've been doing arterial PO2s and PCO2s and PHs over all these years. For many years, of course, I had to use the Riley bubble technique, which is time-consuming, but we have studies on the blood gases going back to 1947.
Today they're so commonplace that...
It's so easy today. It's hard to realize for a young technician that it used to be so difficult to obtain.
I can remember you used to have to schedule blood gases to be done.
Well, yes. And it took a certain level of proficiency to use a Riley bubble technique. Once you learned it, it was very good, and we always ran it in duplicate. But it would take about an hour to do a blood gas.
So many of our lung problems are, however, related to personal habits, smoking. What are your views on that?
Well, smoking, I feel, is much more detrimental right now by far than any effects of the air pollution that we're having here. I mean, it's air pollution at its worst. We did some studies on cigarette smoking a number of years ago, and using a smoking device, we were able to demonstrate changes in compliance very easily, just smoking one cigarette. I had a smoking device so that when the person breathed in, they take in a little cigarette smoke. But with a nose clip on and breathing through the mouthpiece, a smoker couldn't tell when he was smoking when he wasn't, but a non-smoker could. But it was amazing, that is. But measuring compliance, the pressure-volume relationship before and immediately after, there was a significant change in just smoking one cigarette. And then the carbon monoxide hemoglobin saturation of some cigarette smokers is tremendously high. I had one fellow here with a saturation of 21% CO. This fellow complained of chest pain. He'd been diagnosed as a cardiac. He went through the clinic, and they did all the tests on him. They didn't come up with anything really conclusive, but they didn't measure his carbon monoxide hemoglobin. So we did arterial blood studies, and since he was a heavy cigarette smoker, he had a high hemoglobin, high hematocrit. When we found out what the CO level was, we got on him, and he got him to stop smoking. And I did a follow-up study on him after 3 months, and his CO level was down to 3%. And his chest pain disappeared. That's the most severe case I've ever seen. But you can almost tell a cigarette smoker from a non-smoker by just measuring the carbon monoxide hemoglobin level. Most of them will run up in around 6 to 10%. This here at sea level, now at your altitude in Denver, it would be even worse.
Yes,
because your inspired PO2 is less to start with.
What's the answer to the smoking problem?
Now, many have given it up. American College of Chest Physicians, when I first started going to their meetings back in the late 40s, the smoke used to be so thick in there you could hardly see your slides. And now, at a chest meeting, you hardly can find a doctor that's smoking a single cigarette.
The doctors must have learned something along the way.
I think the chessmen got the point, but I'm not sure that all doctors did.
Along the way, Hurley, you've been a leader in studies of air pollution. You've won awards, and I'd be very interested to review some of your ideas and observations about air pollution.
Well, the biggest study we did out here was selecting patients that we had done complete studies that lived in this area, that had far advanced severe emphysema. we brought them into the hospital at times where we did our studies to get a baseline when the air was fairly good. Then when we'd have an air pollution episode, we'd bring them in. After 2 days, we found it took about 2 days to get our maximum response from air pollution, do studies, and then we put them in a room where we had activated carbon filters, and we kept them in there. And again, we found it took about 2 days to get changes. We did find we could get significant changes that we could measure. The residual error was one. Another one was a nitrogen washout that showed a significant improvement on a breath-by-breath analysis, just putting them on oxygen breathing and running continuous recordings of each breath of the concentration of nitrogen. We didn't get much changes in the blood gases because these people had severe emphysema and they already had abnormal values on that. Smog produces spasm, a certain amount of bronchospasm. And when you take them away from it, that was reversible.
And you could actually measure this in your laboratory?
Yes, we did. I had the opportunity to go as a consultant for the Army to Japan on this Tokyo-Yokohama asthma. And that appears to be pure an allergic type of bronchitis. So it affected young individuals, some of them with no previous history of breathing difficulty. And again, I recommended they put in activated carbon filters, which they did at Camp Zama, and they can bring these people in and keep them in for a day or two, and everything cleared up, and the doctors thought they was all right and sent them home.
What do you think the solution to air pollution is?
Well, it's been a hard problem to solve until we get cleaner cars, and the industry is still contributing a lot here in Los Angeles. That is, some say the industry still contributes more than the car now with the cleanups that have been accomplished on cars. But it hasn't really gotten any worse, it doesn't seem to me, in the last few years compared to what it was back in the late 50s.
So the problem isn't increasing like it might have been without some action.
Well, I don't think we would be able to live here if they hadn't done anything about it.
I'm interested in some of your very early work. Julius Comroe, as you know, is interested in the first published papers of people that have made major contributions to our field. You once worked in marine biology with mussels.
When I was in University of Missouri, during the summers I worked for the Bureau of Fisheries. We made complete surveys of the upper Mississippi River from Keokuk north before they put in the dams, and that included taking samples of the water, the aquatic life, and I made some studies on the freshwater mussel, the heartbeat of the freshwater mussel, which is a very simple affair. They are very susceptible, these mussels, to pollution. The pearl button industry used to be a big thing in the upper Mississippi, but it's practically completely disappeared because they don't longer have the mussels.
Hurley, amongst your many contributions to our field, you've helped the respiratory therapist field immensely. Been on the board of directors since 1966, I think. I've just come from their annual meeting, and I'm amazed to see the progress that this specialty, this paramedical specialty, or allied health specialty, whatever you call it, has made.
Yeah, it's really been tremendous. I think it's very much needed. Because one of the criticisms, I think, of use of intermittent positive pressure breathing has been the fact that so many places it was given improperly. The technicians were not trained properly. They just put a mask or a mouthpiece on the patient, tell them to go ahead without instructing the patient how to breathe. Well, I've seen that so often. It becomes all the more important to have technicians trained to use it properly in these units.
Technicians today are asking about the expanded role of the technician or therapist. Do you have a view about this?
Well, their training has been improving all the time compared to what it was when we first started out. The oral examinations are really pretty rough. A lot of doctors would have trouble asking some of the questions that they ask today of respiratory therapists. And I think the better trained they are, the better job they're going to be able to do. That is, the physician still has to make the decision, but if the technicians can carry out what he wants in a better manner, that seems to be very helpful.
Hurley, you've recently retired from nearly a quarter of a century on the faculty of the University of Southern California. What are you doing now? Doing some writing?
Oh, a little, not very much. I'm still a consultant for Social Security on hearing cases and disability. You miss your work when you retire, and don't get away from that.
Well, in a sense, I've broken into your retirement today to have this visit. You've made so many contributions to our field, I wanted to review some of these. What do you see for the future in pulmonary medicine?
I think it will continue to grow or improve. It seems to me today that the training of pulmonary physicians is much better than it used to be, and a much larger number of individuals are interested in the subject. When I first came out here, I had patients referred as far away as San Francisco, Phoenix, Tucson, San Diego, because there were no facilities for doing any type of work. I had the only pulmonary function lab in all of Southern California. Today, every hospital has usually some facilities for doing some pulmonary function studies. So for young men, it seems to me that there's a great future in specializing in pulmonary disease.
Hurley Motley, you began as a basic scientist interested in physiology and water pollution. In wartime, you went to high altitude, took the pressure breathing technology to the laboratory, applied it to patients, and objectively measured what you did in your studies and your patient care. You've been a scientist, you've been a physician, you've been a teacher in your writings and in your continued inquiry into the environment and its relationship to the lung. Thank you very much, Hurley Motley.
Thank you. It's an honor to be interviewed by you, Tom.
This has been an interview with Dr. Hurley Motley, a pioneer in pulmonary medicine. Breon Laboratories was pleased to provide this interview as a continuing service to the medical profession.